Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody! Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations, put out by Target Books from 1973 onward in publication order. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. This week, we take our overdue season break in between the 1982-83 novelizations and the 1984-85 novelizations. To be specific, we are already two books into 1984, season 6 of this show, as defined by Anchor/Spotify. We've already talked about Maudrin Undead with Stephen B. from the New to Who podcast in episode 82, and we've talked about Kinda with Dale Smith in episode 83. We have coming up two more Peter Davison novelizations. Episode 84 will be Snake Dance, episode 85 will be Enlightenment, and that is the end of the run of 10 straight Peter Davison novelizations. Then Target will spend a lot of time dipping back into the past. Coming up elsewhere in Season 6, we have the very first novelization published from Television Season 3, which spans Galaxy 4 up through the War Machines. Many, although not all, of the Season 3 novelizations are going to be published in 1986 and 1987. That will be Season 7 of this podcast, although quite some time down the road. But we will be reaching the very beginning of the Season 3 novelization run, the TV Season 3 novelization run, during this season, Season 6 of Doctor Who Literature. In order to help guide us on that transition, I am very, very pleased to devote this week's bonus episode to a new friend of mine, and I suspect he'll be a friend for a very long time. That is Ian Potter. Ian Potter, who has written many, many big finishes. Ian Potter, who has written two of the Black Archive series from Obverse Books, both of which we will spend a lot of time talking about today. And Ian Potter, who works with Rift Tracks, certainly a very impressive body of work. I had a really, really enjoyable, long-form conversation with Ian just this afternoon, and I'm pleased to give it to you now as a bonus episode. We will talk a lot about Ian's two Black Archives, Carnival of Monsters, published in 2018, and The Mythmakers, published earlier this year, 2023. Carnival of Monsters we have already covered on Doctor Who Literature. That came out in 2022. That was episode 28 with Pete Lambert, a good friend of the show and a frequent guest whose voice you will be hearing again. Episode 28, though, was a long time ago in the life of the show. I do a weekly series, and sometimes the finer points of episodes from many, many months ago are no longer fresh in my head. I am pretty sure that I learned a lot more about Carnival of Monsters from the Black Archive and from talking to Ian than I would have known when I read and researched and recorded the Carnival of Monsters episode. Maybe I'll have to bring Pete back for a redo, or at least an update of episode 28, Carnival of Monsters, so I can apply the knowledge that I got from Ian's book and from Ian today. The Mythmakers is going to be coming up later this season with a different guest. I am very much looking forward to that. The Mythmakers, I have already discussed the vinyl release on a Trap 1 episode in 2021, and we'll be discussing the novelization. But the Black Archive is a good overlap between the TV episode, which I have already discussed, and the novelization, which again is coming up. Ian has some very interesting points to make in the Mythmakers Black Archive about what elements of Donald Cotton's original draft script did not get televised but wound up in the novelization instead. I will have links in the show notes here to all of Ian's work. I would strongly encourage you to purchase and read his Black Archives, which are available as print editions as well as ebook editions. As we'll talk about over the coming show, I really, really enjoy the behind-the-scenes stuff and how these episodes evolve between the draft script to the rehearsals, production, transmission, the novelization. So we're going to go deep into that today. But two other little bits of business to talk about here in the preliminaries. Pluto TV. I did watch part of a Doctor Who episode on Pluto TV tonight, and it wound up being the Mind of Evil episode 5. Love the Mind of Evil. That was absolutely one of my favorite novelizations growing up. That novelization will also be discussed during the season 6 of Doctor Who Literature. It is one of the 1985 novelizations. We are again in early 1984 still, going in publication order. What fascinates me about Carnival of Monsters on television is the relationship between Roger Delgado, Katie Manning, and John Pertwee. What interests me about The Master is that this is the super suave, urbane Roger Delgado Master who kills a lot of incidental characters along the way, particularly in his very first story, Terror of the Autons. But then Anthony Ainley, who takes over the Master during the Christopher H. Bidmead season 18/19 trilogy, the first two things that that incarnation of the Master does is kill Nissa's father and kill Tegan's Auntie Vanessa. Certainly ups the stakes as far as the Master's villainy goes. Maybe that's one of the reasons why we think so highly of the Roger Delgado Master. Although he did terrible things, it was not nearly on the same level as what the Master would later do to the father of one of our companions and the favorite aunt of another one of our companions. Certainly ups the stakes and makes the later incarnation of the Master much more despicable than Roger Delgado, from whom you get the sense from John Pertwee and Katie Manning that the three of them really just love each other underneath it all. Interesting stuff, and we'll have that conversation a little bit more when The Mind of Evil comes up on this show later on this season. Coming up immediately, though, last week in London there was a Target Books event sponsored and organized by James Goss. I really wish that I could have jumped across the pond for that weekend. Due to work obligations, I was not able to. But Doctor Who Literature did have a presence there. Show producer and frequent contributor and another really good friend, Jim Sangster, was there. Jim, what were your thoughts on last week's Target Books Day?
What better way to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the launch of Target's Doctor Who book range than a party right in the middle of where Doctor Who was made? A few months ago, author James Goss tweeted an open invitation to an informal gathering. So on the 16th of July 2023, we joined him at Bush Hall, a venue situated on Uxbridge Road, London, almost equidistant between Lime Grove, the former site of Doctor Who's birthplace, and TV Centre, where most of the Doctor's original run of adventures were recorded. James managed to assemble a wonderfully eclectic bunch of speakers. John Deere, who's better known as an expert on Quatermass creator Nigel Neal, kicked off the day with an appropriate celebration of the work of Terence Dix. Nigel Robinson, editor of the books in the 1980s, discussed his so far unreleased adaptation, a new adaptation, of An Unearthly Child. There were deep dives into the works of Donald Cotton, David Fisher and Jerry Davis. TV writer Keith Temple performed a reading from the prologue of his newly released novel Of Planet of the Ood, and was later overjoyed to learn that copies of the book had been rushed over for sale courtesy of Forbidden Planet. Interview panels brought us insights into the technical aspects of creating the range. So, artist Jeff Cummings was there to discuss his groundbreaking contributions to the cover art, and he was also on hand at the back of the room selling prints of some of his most popular covers. Later on, Nigel Robinson joined Steve Cole and Michael Stevens to reveal their different approaches as editors of Doctor Who books over the years. With one eye on the current trends in Marvel and DC movies, writer Nev Fountain gave us a brilliant insight into what might have been with a monologue about the multiverse of Ian Chesterton on TV, film and book, and how our perceptions of the character might differ depending on which version we first encountered. Comedian Molly Marsh sucked the oxygen out of the room as the audience gasped at the suggestion that Doctor Who would be so much better if even more of it had been wiped, just to make Target's versions all the more definitive. Friend of this show, James Couray-Smith, took us into the archives to discover two different disputes between writers and script editors. One that's been preserved on BBC-headed notepaper between Terence Dudley and Eric Saywood over how to present the concepts of witchcraft in K-9 and Company, while the other can be pieced together from incompatible anecdotes in various interviews with Donald Tosh and John Lucarotti about who precisely steered the massacre into production. And in both cases, so James argues, the truth was partly revealed in how the authors approached novelising their scripts. Two presentations really stood out for me, though. Rob Shearman, without notes, shared his own personal journey through the Target books, from a nervous child who didn't even watch the show because the opening titles and the leading man were too scary for him, to the very moment when he received an email inviting him to adapt his own story, Dalek. Spoiler, he said yes. Meanwhile, curator John McClay, who's been working on an exhibition of Doctor Who cover art, revealed to a rapt audience just how many of the original cover pieces still survive, and how many have been lost, possibly forever. It wouldn't be Doctor Who without missing bits, would it? So, it was an amazing day. My thanks to James Goss, our genial host, who thought it would be a nice thing to do to mark this anniversary, and was rewarded with a packed hall full of people who wanted to do just that. It was a very happy time and place, so thanks, James. This is roving reporter Jim Sangster handing you back to Jason in the studio.
And thanks so much, Jim, if by studio you mean my dining room. Every time I hear Jim speak and then I hear my voice on the playback, it is like Laurence Olivier and Danny Kaye in the same presentation. Ugh, I really should have Jim just narrate the whole series, shouldn't I? Anyway, in other Doctor Who transactions news, I am slowly rebuilding the pieces of my Doctor Who collection that I lost earlier this year, certainly against my will. I have now acquired, thanks to eBay, Doctor Who A Celebration, the Peter Haining / Jeremy Bentham 20th Anniversary Hardcover Coffee Table Book, and I also have one of the two FASA, F-A-S-A, Doctor Who role-playing game books, Doctor Who and the Vortex Crystal. The other one, The Rebel's Gamble, I had kept with me, although the Vortex Crystal I had stored off-site and was now lost. So I have Vortex Crystal back, and I've pulled out a trusty pair of dice, and I've been playing it. I do hope to devote future bonus episodes of Doctor Who Literature to some of these peripheral books, the hardcovers, the Target nonfiction, the role-playing books, the choose-your-own-adventure-style books. I'm also toying with the idea of doubling the frequency of my bonus episodes and doing one after every year's worth of Target books rather than every two, but that is an administrative choice that can certainly be made behind the scenes in the coming weeks, and I will certainly tell you about that if that is what comes to pass. In the meantime, enough preliminaries. I'm very excited to throw it over to Ian Potter for this week's bonus episode. Let's get to it.
Hello, fellow time travelers, and welcome to the Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast, the only podcast to discuss, in story order, all the Doctor Who novelizations. My name is Tony Whitt, and every 2 weeks or so, I'm joined by a 2-3-person discussion panel, including our so-called expert who's been a Who fan since 1979. That would be me. We also get the views of intermediate, casual, and novice fans who either have never seen the show or who have never read these books until these podcasts, including
Dalton Hughes
and
Allison Fitz-Seyfried.
You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find good podcasts, or even ones like ours. You're listening to the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. Enjoy your travels.
So my next guest has a very, very, very long list of Doctor Who related credits between Big Finish Audio, Big Finish Print, and my main topic of interest these days, the Black Archives series. Ian Potter, welcome to Doctor Who Literature. Very happy to have you.
Very happy to be here, Jason. And hello, Smudge, who's just been lifted across your stereo field. You won't have been able to hear that, but maybe we can put a whoosh on in post-production.
Yes, Smudge is a regular on this show. I think Smudge has been present for every audio that I've done on Doctor Who Literature. Now, my Big Finish collection is rather on the small side, and I don't think I will ever have the time to be able to listen to everything Big Finish produces. But the Black Archives, I read those whenever I can, and I have both of your books now. Before we talk about your Black Archives and your other work, let's talk about you. What was your entryway into Doctor Who fandom?
Well, it's funny because I felt for a long time detached from Doctor Who fandom because I'd enjoyed it as a small boy. One of my earliest memories, is of seeing the trailer for Curse of Peladon on original transmission and going, oh, they're showing the episode now. And then they've just cut. It was just a minute or two in the TARDIS and then the TARDIS falling down the cliff. And then later that evening, it was on again. And I remember going, oh, so television is made and they can play it back at another time. I must have been four. And I was already watching Doctor Who then. And that was in my head. So fandom for me personally went way back to then. And it was an ordinary part of life, I guess, until towards the end of the Tom Baker era, where it stopped being a thing that normal people were into and began to be more of a smaller interest. And I guess I met organized fandom in 1980 something, probably about 82, standing in W.H. Smith's, which is the shop that everyone bought their targets from in the UK. And there were a bunch of people who were from a Sheffield, wasn't officially DWAS, but it was a Sheffield Doctor Who local group. And so one of the first people I met relating to Doctor Who fandom was Andrew Pixley, who was, he was there with a guy called Dave Palfreyman and a few of us who did a magazine called Time Screen, which was really quite important in early kind of fan criticism of general telefantasy, as it was called quite grandly. And they invited me to come along to a few of their meetings where they showed old Doom Watches and Adam Adamant Lives and Doctor Who's on this kind of in the back room of a pub. And as a teenage boy, this was kind of amazing. There was this extra world. And then you found out you could get hold of Deadly Assassin, which I was obsessed with from my memory of it on TV and from reading the book, you know, that they could get you an Australian copy that because it was still airing over in Australia, whereas in Britain, we had kind of a limit on the number of repeats you could have out of time, as they called it. So, you know, things from a year or two ago were fine, but the actors union equity were very keen that you weren't just putting actors out of work by just showing repeats all the time. So at that period, we were very limited on repeats. And this whole world of Doctor Who opened up to me. I was already a big reader and a big fan of audio drama. I used to listen to Radio 4 intensely. For comedy and drama, quite a bookish boy, and I went to Manchester University and read drama, where it was a period. By this point, we're in the kind of Colin Baker era. It was Time of the Rani Part Two was the first one I saw at college, and I had to find a room with a like-minded soul.
Oh, wow.
Who wouldn't go, well, we can't watch Coronation Street on the other side. But yeah, it felt like it was a smaller cult, and there was the Science Fiction Society at Manchester. I suppose I drifted into fandom that way. But because that was that, you know, my university time was very much towards the back end of the Targets, and then the new adventures and so on were coming in after that. My disposable income meant that I wasn't really buying the Targets anymore. I think I bought the Remembrance book because I read DWB, which is a kind of influential fanzine, and it got such a glowing write-up. But yeah, so I missed the NA generation and the MA generation by probably 2 or 3 years, and then I didn't get a job where there was internet until about the mid-90s. I became a curator of television at the National Museum of Photography, Film and Television in the UK. It's now rebranded several times, but it was a great institution at the time. And I guess I discovered Radwa and the stuff that was coming up about the upcoming TV movie. But at a point where fandom had already kind of developed, and I felt I wasn't part of that. And because I was also a curator of television, because Doctor Who had a fairly bad rep at the time, you kind of sold yourself much more as a general fan of the medium, which I am. Specifically, British TV had this interesting period where it's a combination of theatre and radio with tiny little bits of film inserts. A very different medium entirely to really filmic television as become established worldwide as the way you do it. It felt like a genre I was very much in love with throughout, but Doctor Who is a great way to understand it because it was in continuous production through the 60s through to the 80s, and you saw the way that day-to-day, moderately resourced television worked, but it had the advantage that it was pushing constantly on the video and the sound effects. So it was, what can you do with what we've got? And Doctor Who was stretching the medium as far as it would go. And so it was a very useful text, we might say, for getting to understand the way telly worked. That's a long answer. So yeah, then I guess round about the late 90s, I met through internet stuff, Mark Miklowski, who wrote a little bit for the BBC Books, and a guy called Matt Fitton. Matt Kimpton, who was a fan, who very, very clever guy, sadly died very young. And I kind of ended up at a couple of slightly social things, but I hadn't really been aware that existed. And I kind of felt slightly at a remove to it. Though the internet now, I feel I do belong to fandom because I feel, you know, you've had Jim Kure Smith on here, you've had Paul Dale Smith, you've had Jim Sangster, who are all people I primarily know through Doctor Who and through the internet. But socially, I think I've met both Jims a couple of times, never met Dale, and he did the same university course as me about 3 years later, and we've never quite intersected.
Yeah, Dale is the person who put us directly in touch, and I am very grateful to Dale for that. And Jim Sangster is an enormous part of this podcast because he is my American to English translator. As an American fan, I'm a few years behind you. I started watching the show on PBS in 1984. I did not discover fandom until Rekkaard's Doctor Who, when I got to college, or university, I should say. My freshman year of college, the spring of 1992, you had to go to the basement of the administration building, give your driver's license, and fill out a series of forms in order to be given an email account. And I was just emailing my high school friends for 3 months, and then I was introduced to newsgroups, Usenet, Rekkaard's Doctor Who, and I immediately thought, oh, I must jump in with both feet and make my opinions heard, because everybody has a right to hear what I have to say. And of course, that was not very good netiquette. So my early posts on Rekkaard's Doctor Who generated a lot of controversy. I later became a regular poster on Rekkaard's for the next several years. Many of the friends that I made on Rekkaard's have been on this show, and I have been incorporating interesting Rekkaard's posts that I can remember from the mid-1990s into this show. So Johnny Byrne was on Rekkaard's posting about Warriors of the Deep. We'll be hearing from that. Kate Orman, when she was after she wrote Left-Handed Hummingbird, The New Adventure, had some things to say about the historical accuracy of the Aztecs. So I'll be featuring that on this program when the Aztecs comes up.
Yeah.
So I went from being an American fan who had no connection to fandom or Doctor Who magazine for 8 years, watching the show in a vacuum, to being a frequent, if not a valued, contributor to Rekkaard's Doctor Who. So I went from 0 to 60 in no time flat. But for me, The New Adventures began my first year of college. So I began reading the New Adventures the second that I turned age 18. So the NAs and the MAs were a huge, huge part of my fandom journey, whereas you're a couple of years ahead of me, so you managed to miss the NAs and go straight into Big Finish instead, because Big Finish comes in about the late 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of dip back afterwards, and there are a few NAs I've read, a few, you know, I've read Love and War, and I've read, what else? I'll tell you the thing I read at the time, because just it was digestible with my kind of work schedule, is I read the Decalogue books were the first way I went into the Virgin books, and then I picked up various bits and pieces. But after the TV movie, I heard all the hype about Alien Bodies when we reached that point, and I read that, and I was very impressed with an awful lot of what was going on there, and I read a few around that period. And then I got I had a job working as a researcher on a BBC TV series, and so I went to the Fitzroy Tavern, which was the kind of London meetup of Doctor Who fans, and I got kind of in email correspondence with Jack Rayner at that point, because she was working on the BBC books, and she was in the next office block along. It was just outside Television Centre where the BBC books publishing were, and so again, and socially, that led to her going. Because I also do sound design because of my interest in kind of in audio, going back to the Radio 4 days, I'd put in a sample of audio work to Nick Briggs, who was doing Dalek Empire. He wanted someone else to do the sound design for Time of the Daleks, the first Paul McGann thing. And so I did the sound design on that. So I was aware of Big Finish, and I'd started buying them. But it was Jack Rayner who said, do you want to try writing a short story? And so that was really... I kind of slipped into Big Finish with it. I knew I wanted to do the sound design. I've always loved writing. I've always been a writer. But I was very lucky to get the opportunity and kind of simpatico people who'd let me have a play and fail publicly. You know, I didn't have a kind of fanzine background. I hadn't built up the contacts or possibly the writing style. But it was a great time, actually, I have to say. And it's kind of astonishing that you think, oh, these are connections I made with people over 20 years ago. You know, Jack, who I'm in fairly regular contact with, and bless her, still uses me on Big Finish things. I've seen her 3 times in the entirety of that period, you know. It may only be 2, actually. I think it's 2. Yeah. So it's bizarre that you... people talk about these kind of fake social relationships you get online, but you genuinely do make real connections. You know, parasocial—that's the word I was looking for. But they really are. It's just a new way of communicating with people and finding your tribe, really. And I've been very lucky to find my tribe in Doctor Who, the Sever Team.
Oh, and I'm glad to have you as part of my tribe as well, because my Rec Arts Doctor Who connections, many of them have appeared on the show, and many of them have graduated from people that I emailed with to people that I've met in real life several times. So Doctor Who fandom has become a huge part of my social life, as well as my interest and my podcast hobby. So you and I both found our tribe in the end, even though we started watching the show in isolation. In terms of Big Finish audios, are you given a general plot idea and you come back with a script, or do you pitch a plot idea or a line to write it for and they say yes, go ahead?
It really does vary from project to project. The things that the things I've done most recently, there's one of the plays in the Hebe and Purity sequence. Basically there was a 4-box set arc set out, and I was offered a slot setting up a new arc in the 4th box set. But I actually saw an opportunity in the shape of the 3rd arc and thought, actually, because Hebe is very much a character who's connected to the city of Sheffield, which is where I'm living, where I've been living now for decades. And also she's very connected with water. There was a really catastrophic flood in Sheffield in the Victorian era, which felt like it could connect in with lots of strands we were pulling together. And so in that case, it's a combo of we know what's got to be achieved in this story to take us to the next section of the arc, but really how you get from A to B is down to you. Then the thing after that, which hasn't been announced yet, though, if you were determined, as some people are, hunting through kind of spotlight actors, things you could find it. Really, it was very much for a thing, a box set, where every story is about monsters. I was told the other two stories about monsters that were being done. And I thought, well, here's an area for something I could do that kind of fits in with those. And then there's another box set, which I can't... Well, yeah, there's two other things I can't really talk about yet. One is very much was, would you write for this character? And I suggested a period in their history and said, yeah, go for that. And that was... And really, I had a kind of thematic idea and that seemed to fit. And that just came together. The other one is, again, it's the end of a box set and there are certain things we have to set in place. So that one went through about three iterations of plots that also are about setting up themes for a second box set. I'm sorry, that's so woolly, but just half of those things are written and half of those things aren't written yet. And, you know, one of them's recorded, one's waiting actor availability. So yeah, it's a bit of a mixture, really. And you adapt, you know, you adapt to what you're given. And sometimes it's really useful just to be given a very limited box to play in. And there was a thing Dennis Spooner used to say. He had two things about writing, which I think are really useful. One was he talked about this dramatic W of things, big moments, quiet moments, big moments, da 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 da. And the other thing he said was when he was asked to write for a series, he always looked for the weak spot in the premise and how you could exploit it. So if he was writing for the Champions, who were a invulnerable superhero for team, he'd go, well, what happens if they meet other invulnerable people? And then he'd try and write a story that exploited what the funny bits that doesn't quite make sense, or not necessarily that, the area of the concept where you go, well, hang on, da, 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 and it's quite a fanish response, really, is what can I do with this that uses what's special about it? And his kind of way was find the weakness and, I guess, in a way, explain why it's not a weakness.
Much of what I want to talk to you about today is the William Hartnell era. And turning back to your Big Finish momentarily, mm-hmm. you have written two William Hartnell adventures for Big Finish, narrated by Maureen O'Brien and Peter Purvis. Did you say, I must write a William Hartnell yeah. story, or were you solicited to write for Hartnell, which dovetails into your Black Archives work?
The first audio that I wrote for Big Finish, basically they said, would you write something for Ian to narrate? I did Companion Chronicles and I did The Early Adventures. And basically they wanted something that was about Ian and Barbara nearly getting home, but they're not quite in the right period. And so I wrote a thing there, which initially was all about a new town being set up. It was, and it was kind of run on centralized lines and da 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 da. And it was a kind of, and a lot of it was based around the schooling of how these children in this town were kind of being brainwashed. And then they came back to me and said, that's quite a nice idea. We're setting up a series called Countermeasures, which is, well, actually at the time it was called the Jensen Project. But I think actually there's already, or the Jensen Files, but there's already a film called that. And would you basically do that story or a version of something that builds on that story for Countermeasures and something else for Ian and Barbara? So I've got two commissions very early on, both set in the world of the 1960s. And I think I got kind of typecast as kind of, because I'm in my mid-50s and because I'm aware of kind of archive television from the 50s and 60s, I'm very aware of the kind of voices of those characters, whereas sometimes a younger writer, there's a chunk of work already to get stuff coming out of Ian and Barbara's mouths that sounds like people from Britain of the 1960s. They haven't I mean, I haven't got the, I've got 2 years of lived experience, the 1960s. But I'm more aware of that kind of the way that British language has shifted. So I did those, and then that led to another Ian Companion Chronicle. And then I did a Vicky Companion Chronicle, which was maybe the wrong order. Anyway, I did one that was essentially a two-hander for Maureen O'Brien and another actress, which I adored, called The Unwinding World, it was called. And she was lovely in that. And that was largely because I'd heard a lot of radio drama she'd done, and I thought Maureen O'Brien is such a great actress that I really wanted to give her loads more to do. And I kind of pushed on from her fermenting revolution in the Space Museum to have her essentially manipulating a society into collapsing.
Yes.
It was already collapsing, but to a point that all that the Doctor and the companions can get home. And, you know, she's fantastic in that. And I also did the two early adventures with her and Peter Purvis. And they are incredibly gifted actors. Peter Purvis is underestimated as an actor in Britain because he had a period as a children's television presenter and then became known mainly as a presenter. But he does so much work with Stephen. He is essentially the lead actor in Doctor Who for a vast chunk of his time on the show. While taking the weight off William Hartnell, reacting to mistakes he made, but also protecting him and being his ally when he's in really quite a horrible situation. And Maureen O'Brien, I think, is an absolute gift. And I think it's an absolute travesty that they got rid of her because she really, really is and remains a fine, fine, fine actress. Or actor, as she probably is now.
That leads me to your work on Black Archives. You've published two so far, Mythmakers, which just came out, and Carnival of Monsters, which came out several years ago, but which I only just acquired this week, because I do not have, unfortunately, a complete set of Black Archives. That's Catch as Catch Can. Mythmakers, Jim Sangster and I have been working on a Doctor Who literature episode about production season 3 in the 60s, which goes from Mythmakers through Smugglers. You have 7 companions in 8 stories. You have 2 producers. You have 2 story editors. You have William Hartnell being bundled out the door, first by John Wiles, then by Innes Lloyd. And that all begins with Mythmakers. Maureen O'Brien comes back from holiday. She reads the scripts. Wait a minute, Vicky leaves in this one? And that's just really the beginning of the end. Everything bad that happens to Doctor Who over the next year really stems from that decision to fire Vicky, it seems.
I think the cascade of it comes in from John Wiles, I suspect, feeling vulnerable, wanting to stamp his authority on the series. And basically, he's running Galaxy 4 just before it goes out in Verity's name. He's essentially line producing it. And Maureen O'Brien is critical of the script, as was Peter Purvis, in script conference with the writer. And basically, John Wiles stamps her down. And I think partly I think he stamps down her wanting to change lines to suit her character and to work with the drama better. Because he knows that if she is allowed to change her lines, William Hartnell will be very keen to change his lines. And he will be doing it more about making it stuff he can remember rather than stuff that's true for the character. And so I think in an instinct to kind of protect the writer, because John Wiles was originally a writer and then a story editor and became a producer, which isn't normally the natural way it would develop within the BBC, he stamps his authority and says, we're getting rid of her, without really thinking it through properly. They don't have a proper place to get rid of her. They've got stories coming up that still require a 2 companion setup. So they have to engineer a new girl companion. Then they find that actually the girl companion they've got is going into a science fiction adventure where basically they have to stop every 5 minutes to explain stuff to her. So you can see, if you look at Terry Nation's drafts for the Dalek Master Plan, he's calling the character Vicky right up to the point she dies, even though he knows it's going to be someone else. You know, he leaves a note asking Donald Tosh to write something appropriate for the girl that you've established when they kill her. And then they think, oh, well, we'll get Sarah Kingdom in. but they've hired an actress who doesn't want to be connected with Doctor Who long term. So then they go, oh, well, there's a girl in the next one, in Anne Chaplet. Oh, hang on, that's going to be exactly the same as the girl from the past, Katerina. That's not going to work either. And so then we get Dodo shoehorned in with a kind of fudged connection to Anne Chaplet. And then the poor woman, I mean, it's strange. For a long time, Doctor Who fandom claimed she had a Cockney accent, which was because most of it was written down. We didn't have the audio. Right. And you hear her. And she's broad Mancunian, only she's a kind of weird broad Mancunian that only Daphne Moon on Frasier ever spoke, or largely. It's a quite broad comic Northwest England voice. And then they have to change that because it's too big, and they undermine her character. And then obviously Innes Lloyd inherits, you know, and then Wiles wants to get rid of Hartnell and fails because Hartnell goes over his head to stay in the series after he's been trying to write him out in the Celestial Toy Room. And then Dodo's out because Innes Lloyd, the new producer, coming in after John Wiles resigns because he can't get his own way and get rid of the lead actor. I mean, it's an absolute rolling disaster. And it's miraculous that really the stories are as good as they are. I'm not a huge fan of the Dalek Master Plan because I don't really like Doctor Who in its kind of comic strip zip from world to world kind of format. I'm much happier where they land in a situation and they work their way out of it, or they find the issue there. Once you're hopping from planet to planet, it feels a bit Perils of Pauly, and it feels a bit kind of, it feels like a Flash Gordon serial, a Larry Buster Crab kind of Flash Gordon. But, you know, the Mythmakers and the Massacre are astonishing. The arc has an awful lot going for it. Gunfighters does get a little bit, you know, I think that the new production team aren't happy with it. They've inherited it and they're not happy with the direction. Performances are great, but it's still a Western in the UK, and it's not at the level of the Mythmakers where they really can go to kind of quite elevated language in that way, which really plays to Donald Cotton's strengths. It's more. Oh, I see. I'm running out of the words now. It's not the dreadful piece of work that people always claim it is, nor is it the reclaimed classic that people claim it is, but it's pretty good. And then the War Machines, you know, I'm skipping over the Savages here, which again has a little hint of John Wiles and his kind of anti-racist thinking in it. It feels like a very solid and strong parable, and it kind of points the direction to a way a lot of Doctor Who is going to go. And then the War Machines is very much the template for 70s Doctor Who right there. I mean, it's all over the shop, and it's no wonder that everyone was confused and insecure making it. In some ways, I think we're quite lucky the production files aren't really there for a lot of this period, because I think there would just be a lot of fury and confusion. I mean, the memos we do have with John Wiles complaining about sets or about makeup or about the having been overruns in studio because an actor forgot their lines, it all feels quite rancorous. Sorry, that was too long an answer, but there you go.
Oh no, that was gold. I mean, I love the black and white era. We got the William Hartnell package on PBS in the States when I was 11 going on 12, and I had grown up with black and white television in the household. My own personal TV in my bedroom was a 13-inch black and white rabbit ears. So I spoke the visual language of black and white as a kid. So the Hartnell stuff immediately appealed to me. I did my classic series pilgrimage in 13 months between October of 2020, the pandemic, and early November 2021. So I watched everything, two episodes, 55 minutes a night, from Unearthly Child and Cave of Skulls all the way up through parts 2 and 3 of Survival in about 13 months. Season 3 is majestic because every story jumps back and forth across space and time and throughout history. I think the middle bits of Dalek's Master Plan might not work so well. The two-part Egypt sequence should work better than it does. you have the makings of a grand 7-part Egyptian historical epic, and instead it's a 2-part comedy pseudo-historical. And then, of course, you have the Christmas and New Year's Day episode in the middle as well with its own style of comedy. But I think parts 1 through 4 and 11 and 12 of Dalek's Master Plan are about as strong as Doctor Who ever got.
Yeah.
As an American who grew up on stories of the Wyatt Earp TV series, which ran for about 12 years and had a ballad playing in the middle of every episode, I think The Gunfighters is right on par with American Westerns of the 50s and 60s, which you can now stream most of them. You can stream all of The Rifleman. You can stream all of the Wyatt Earp TV series. Steve McQueen's Wanted Dead or Alive, about a Wild West bounty hunter. American Westerns are incredibly powerful TV. That's where Gene Roddenberry got his start, moving on to Star Trek. So I think The Gunfighters works very well. And this very day, I received in the mail my replacement copy of Doctor Who, A Celebration, which I had this as a kid. I read it over and over again, especially the Jeremy Bentham chapter, because that was my only exposure to a lot of these missing stories. I lost my copy when, thanks to administrative error, I lost almost my entire Doctor Who collection outside of the novelizations, which I kept in my house. Everything else stored off-site I lost. So I was able to get A Celebration back off eBay for less than 1983 face value. And the first thing I did was turn to the capsule summary of The Gunfighters, which of every story in the first 20 seasons, it's the only one that Jeremy Bentham tears apart. And when I opened up this book in front of you before we started recording, you started quoting verbatim from Jeremy Bentham's review. That's how ingrained it is in our minds.
Well, I mean, it's funny. It's a book that celebrates all of Doctor Who, apart from 4 weeks in 1965 or 1960. It's like, is it 65 or it's 66? By that would be 66 by that point, won't it? Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, it's a, and it's But we, at the same time, we had this kind of absolute, and again, it's because of child perspectives being overwritten. I mean, you work in kind of the legal world, and you know that memory is malleable, and every time you restore a you recall a memory, you overwrite it, and this is why kind of witness testimony can just fall apart because you end up remembering the memory, and these are kids' memories of things they saw decades before. And so the Celestial Toy Room, the Celestial Toy Maker, is this marvelous miracle of television, which the surviving elements of don't really give us, whereas the Gunfighters is this travesty. And again, because of access to was limited to kind of to production people at the time, Innes Lloyd remembers it having had the lowest ratings when it had the lowest audience appreciation. But that becomes a fact and becomes the frame that we watch it through. And you're really lucky, actually, to have had no real fan-received wisdom for, you know, having watched in isolation. Because, you know, I grew up with the Targets as part of my guide through Doctor Who and with Doctor Who magazine, Doctor Who Weekly, as it then was. And there, an orthodoxy did develop that then... I mean, one of the things about the kind of the New Adventures of the Virgin kind of era were things like the discontinuity guide that then kind of this new wave of fandom came through and said, no, you're completely wrong. That's, you know, and, you know, Pertwee's a Tory and all these things that were a reaction against an established view of the series that we hadn't had. Well, that I hadn't had, actually. No, that's not right. No, that you hadn't had. Someone didn't have it anyway. So actually, for you, kind of watching at PBS, who knows what you're getting next, where you are in it. So you kind of drop in media res. Then it's kind of a different world for you picking it up piecemeal and making your own journey. We had a lot of, you know, doing my research on the Mythmakers. I went back to early fandom reviews, and they are. You know, they're kind of 70s. They're utterly scathing, and they're based really on some fundamental misunderstandings and a bunch of rote lore that's been handed down. I mean, they are myths about the Mythmakers. most of the things we know about the Mythmakers or have been told as fandom just don't hold up once you start poking away. I mean, the thing that did surprise me, and I had to to treble check it, is that Max Adrian is the grandson of a guy who came over, a Dutch guy. They settled in Ireland, and he was high church. He was English Catholic, Anglo-Catholic was the phrase they used. And he talks about it in interviews and about having, you know, being heavily into the high church. And this concept that he is Jewish and therefore hated by William Hartnell has grown out of anecdotes in a curious way. And I think genuinely, there are two things that Max Adrian did. He was in intimate review in comedy, and he played a Hungarian refugee who'd come over from, or no, a Viennese refugee, I think, who'd come over, you know, to avoid the Nazis and longed for the intellectual coffee houses and society of those days. And he played Fagin in a very well-regarded Oliver Twist on the television. And I think he's called Max, and people just assumed. And so he probably did suffer anti-Semitic abuse because people assumed he was Jewish, but he absolutely isn't. And there's no evidence of Hartnell. Hartnell had worked with him before. It looks increasingly that the fact that Max Adrian has a whole bunch of lovely scenes with Maureen O'Brien, who adored him, and they are great scenes, and they just on audio alone they shine. He was jealous of his close connection with Maureen O'Brien going, and unhappy that she was leaving, and so Max Adrian gets short shrift for being the witty actor in the room who's charming his friend who's going away. But all these kind of misconceptions just grow and grow and grow, and that's the thing really. When I started doing the Mythmakers book, I wanted first of all to go, you know, this Troilus and Cressida thing, it doesn't make sense because it's not the story of Troilus and Cressida that they end up together. You know, it's right. So that's where I started from. And because I'd done some classics at school, I thought, and I can talk about the archaeology, but I can do the archaeology and the literary sources. But I found constantly, we've just assumed and taken on trust stuff about this series, and it doesn't really bear scrutiny when you dig down.
So talking about William Hartnell's perceived anti-Semitism,
mm-hmm.
I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
I'm very sensitive to anti-Semitism, and there's just so much of it, especially now in the year 2023.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make sense for me about Hartnell, because who are the creatives on the very first series of Doctor Who? Verity Lambert.
Yeah.
You have a long string of actors of Jewish descent who are playing heavies.
Well, I mean yeah, Carol Ann Ford is also Jewish in origin.
Yes, I've read that. I've never heard her talk about it, but I have read that she is a Jewish.
Because I was asked to write a story for Big Finish with Susan and the Doctor about the rise of the Nazis, and I was very, very uncomfortable about it, but I decided to do it as long as I could, because if someone else did it, I'd have to keep my mouth shut, and if I went, oh God, that's really crass, or they've said the Nazis are influenced by an alien from here. And what I wanted to do was a thing that was about the Weimar Republic and how people's minds were twisted into looking for scapegoats. And I engineered it in a kind of contrived way, but apart from a kind of a junior member of the SA, there are no Nazis in my story at all. It's really about the economic state of Germany, that people will come and pick others that you have to exclude, and you have to. But yeah, Hartnell clearly had a lot of racist, you know, he clearly had problems with black people from what we've been told. He may well have distrusted Jewish people, but in his everyday dealings with Jewish people, he seems to have treated them decently. But we can't unpick the man from this distance. I suspect he was very conflicted about a whole bunch of things, and his personal behaviour and possibly his private beliefs were different. But it doesn't ring true to me. you can excuse stuff as being of its time. It's difficult. I find J.K. Rowling has done some really monstrous stuff in the mainstream with all sorts of persecuted and underrepresented people. And Roald Dahl the same, and it's right in the middle of our culture. Hartnell, at least on screen, presented a man who was open to difference and trust and embracing the other and understanding. Perhaps in the canteen he was a less pleasant individual at times, but I don't buy into him as an anti-Semite in the way that we see people dripping poison into the media in the world now are. But we honestly can't say, but I personally feel it's a much more complicated and nuanced thing. And whenever we look at people's attitudes in the 50s and the 60s, you're always going to have to try and filter back to the period and the way Britain was. Britain is, unfortunately, institutionally, a very racist country. And a lot of that is the legacy of empire, which, you know, constantly, as we write the Black Archive books, Carnival of Monsters is all about the exploitation. You know, it's about India. It's everywhere. I mean, the East India Company is a thing. You know, it's very great and very well touched on. Well, very well explained in the Sunmakers Black Archive. But that really informs a hell of a lot. You know, and the places we took over for oil or to exploited local people. There's a nastiness underlying the othering of other people that sits behind even the highest ideals in British society. And that's one of the strange things about Doctor Who, is we have this constant aspiration towards being better and living up to the ideal of British values as we see them. And then we have casually semi-scripted racism dropping into the Celestial Toy Room. That, you know, it's not quite explicitly to be said in the script, but you can understand why the actor said what was said. He was told that the king recites eeny, meeny, miny, mo, and he recited it as it was commonly recited in the UK then. And it's grim. And unfortunately, although I love Donald Cotton as a writer, and he has loads of wit and elegance and fun and erudition to what he does, there's also just tiny little drops of kind of racial stereotyping in his work, which, you know, it's hard to face up to the fact that people you admire have feet of clay. And I know that everything we do now, you know, everything I've written for Big Finish, people can go, oh, that wasn't a very progressive attitude, that there will always be things we're getting wrong, but you just hope to try and make things better.
Yeah, one of the things I love about your Mythmakers Black Archive is you give a very detailed biography of the people involved. So we learn a lot about Donald Cotton. You do this astounding chapter on John Wiles, where I didn't realize how much of Doctor Who's serials that he produced were directly personal to him, having been a refugee from South Africa. And then, of course, you touch on more disturbing aspects of John Wiles' personality, which I will leave people who have not yet read the book to discover for themselves. Pretty jaw-dropping.
I didn't want to flat out make any pronouncements about John Wiles, because there's a lot of circumstantial stuff, but it's very clear from his own writings and actually from some accounts from people who were in plays he directed that he had certain kind of recurring obsessions, which are not necessarily things you would be comfortable having someone produce a family TV serial. I really cannot think that anyone who employed him at the BBC had read his novels and thought, oh yeah, he's a good match for Doctor Who, because they are full of, firstly, a hell of a lot of violence, which is, you know, it's not a surprise that the Dalek Master Plan is full, well, everything's full of people getting massacred in the John Wiles era, really.
Yes.
He believes in in being very strong on death, and he is quite happy to distress the children. There's a very disingenuous little press thing he gives about how Doctor Who's safe and the children watching always know that his friends will be safe at the end. And this is to promote the Dalek Master Plan. He knows he's killing two of them off at this point, and he's still telling the press this. I think he saw himself as quite a literary figure and wanted to be in something better than Doctor Who and was pushing the boundaries of it. But he wasn't really, I don't think, a natural fit for the show. And, you know, I was pleased to discover that of all, you know, there are, again, feet of clay. Despite the things I found about him, I thought that's not great and his decision-making wasn't great. He was staunchly anti-racist. There are quotes all over the place because the kind of received fan wisdom that's developed recently is that the Ark is a racist text because the Monoids are dark-skinned and they're subjugated and they have a revolution where it's overthrown. And it's much muddier than that. And a lot of that is down to production decisions and a lot of it is down to casting. But then to take from TV is always a compromise of directors, writers, producers, designers. The whole thing is a text where the meanings get blurred together. But to take the Ark as evidence of John Wiles as racist is bizarre when the whole reason he's in Britain is because he doesn't want to be part of apartheid South Africa.
You also talk about Michael Leiston-Smith. I have not seen anything Michael Leiston-Smith directed, and it goes beyond obvious to say that we do not have any surviving footage of Mythmakers, apart from a few off-air clips on 8mm, which are close-ups of Vicky, so it doesn't give you a sense of the visual language of the show.
Yes. Whoever the Australian fan was who did those, they adored Maureen O'Brien and they wanted to keep as much as they could because it's very notable that it's mostly Maureen, I think.
But you do astounding work in your Mythmakers Black Archive going through the camera script and telling us exactly what this would have looked like. You talk about, I think it was a glass painting of the city of Troy with live actors walking through it. I would love to see that. There's so much about Michael Leiston's visual language to the show, and this was his only Doctor Who serial.
Yeah.
In fact, you even make the point that his directing downplays the comedy so that on audio appears to be a jarring shift from comedy part one, comedy part two, comedy part three, to tragedy part four. Might not be so pronounced on video because he's de-emphasizing the humorous double-take reaction shots.
Yeah, he's very rarely going for what you would expect a director who works in light entertainment or comedy to do, of going, you know, in our heads, we expect to see Hartnell blustering in close-up when he's mistaken for Zeus and they say, you've come in the guise of a beggar. There's no desire to go in on Hartnell's reaction for that, which feels the natural thing to do. But what the cameras are doing is they're fluid. There's a lot more cutting between characters during discussion. So the cameras are moving around the sets. We're going from face to face. It's kind of about double the rate of shots that you get in an episode like Galaxy 4. It's much, much pacier. And what I did, because I've got connections, having done archive work for the BBC and having been a TV curator, I was managed to find people who could get me access to Zedcar's episodes done by Michael Leiston-Smith, which I think there's about 8. And in that, you can see that he's very much about, I mean, Zedcar's was a series that was pushing at the edge of television in Britain as being quite theatrical, had lots of film inserts, lots of back projection. It had a big cast moving around in cars. So it was all quite dynamic that you went from one lot to another and it was quite speedy, but it was also quite a gritty series. And the Michael Leiston-Smith episodes, very low on humour. There are a couple of humorous characters. Brian Blessed is where he becomes known. He plays one of the policemen, and he's quite a roister, doistering kind of bloke. Again, it's not emphasised. What is emphasised is kind of punch-up car accidents, and, you know, when someone gets knocked down by hit and run, we get a very rapid montage of kind of shocked reactions and a stunt and blood on the face and all the rest of it. It is very gritty and very physical. And there is one episode really that he does, which is written by a guy called Alan Plater, who was a great British TV writer whose work tends towards comedy. And he kills the comedy dead in that. And so my suspicion is that really he was quite an adult dynamic director. And I seem to remember Donald Tosh, Peter Purvis, possibly also Wiles, all are very happy with the bloodthirsty fighting, you know, the action of the Mythmakers. They're all very happy with how that was presented. I have a half suspicion that because we've just got the audio, we get the comedy of Donald Cotton very clearly, but we're not getting at all that maybe Michael Leeson Smith was pulling in a different direction. And if you look at the camera scripts, it does seem to me that he's avoiding playing the gag moments.
Things that delighted me was when Galaxy 4 Episode 3 was recovered over a decade ago. I had a low opinion of Galaxy 4 as a story because the Telesnap reconstructions don't have that level of dynamism, and the novelization, quite frankly, is not super well written. When Derek Martinez's work is recovered, Derek Martinez, I should say, is recovered, he was doing live to studio flashbacks. He was having Stephanie Bidmead monologue direct to camera. It was astounding. I was not expecting Galaxy 4 to look that good. So if we ever get Mythmakers back, I think people will be blown away by what Michael Leeson Smith's direction would have looked like, to the point where he does a very gritty, noisy fight scene between Hector and Achilles, which wasn't supposed to be. It was supposed to be two actors who didn't want to fight, taunting each other. But he has them fighting and clashing swords the whole time. I would love to see that.
Yeah, I think that there probably is a really interesting tension between the visuals and the vocals. I mean, we're clearly getting some big and fine comedy performances here. But I suspect that we're getting, you know, it feels like it's going to be full throttle on the action sequences, even when, as you say, it's pretty clear from the camera script and probably actually from the novelization that Donald Cotton sees the initial fight between Hector and Achilles as them both kind of posturing, but never actually quite getting round to hitting many blows.
Achilles! Over here, stable-keeper! Barbarian horse-worshipper!
Out of breath so soon, my light-foot princeling!
Offend Patroclus, let his father and may better fall!
Murderer! Patroclus was a boy! A boy? Well, he died like a dog, whimpering after his master, Achilles. Come, let me send you to him where he waits in Hades. Let me throw the dog a bone or two. What? So anxious to be gone? I would not keep you for the world.
If the TARDIS hadn't arrived, from the sound of the direction on TV, someone would have got killed there anyway. Whereas the script seems to imply that it's only because the TARDIS has arrived and someone's looking in surprise at what's happened that we actually get a kill at all.
Right. And looking at your Carnival of Monsters book, there is a line in your Carnival of Monsters Black Archive, which basically is the epigraph for this podcast, which is famous for doing episodes that are nearly 2 hours long. You write, "I make no apology for the fact that the discussion of the program you're now reading will end up longer than either the program's script or its novelization, and will probably take longer to read than the program takes to view. There's always more in a script than is on the page, more in a production than ends up on screen, and more than one way to reinterpret it in print." Which leads me to my point about Carnival of Monsters. We picture this as fans as having sprung fully formed from Robert Holmes's brain in a single draft. The point that you raise is that a lot of this is down to Terrence Dix's rewrites.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff in the finished project that Robert Holmes did not conceive of, which was devised in rehearsal and then in post-production with the restructuring of a cliffhanger. Yeah. So it always amazes me that as much as Terrence Dix minimizes his role as story editor on the DVD commentary, saying, oh, my only job was to make sure that we weren't airing a test pattern card on Saturday night. He was doing so much to add value to the show. He was a much more important creator than we might think. So that's fascinating to read as well.
Basically, Terrence Dix is the moral core of Doctor Who. He's the moral core of Carnival of Monsters in that he kind of shifts this away. The scope, which was originally called the Strobe, is originally a kind of TARDIS-like prison done by some people called the Omegans. And obviously that's all gone. And in its place is the kind of more straightforward miniscope concept, and the idea of the Time Lords having stepped in to put them down, the miniscopes. But he writes the Doctor's big speeches about why this is a terrible thing. And he does that throughout. He takes really a quite cynical kind of view that is prevalent in Robert Holmes and cleans it up a bit and there's still the cynicism there, but he makes it have a decent moral lesson for children. And you know, the classic example of that is the death scene in The Sunmakers, where he takes what Robert Holmes wrote and Pennant Roberts delivered on screen and just puts the question mark in there about whether this glorious revolution is quite as glorious as we're making on, if the oppressed become quite so brutal in putting down the people who oppressed them.
I had Lewis Bastin on this show a couple of times, and he did the Black Archive on Sunmakers, so we've had a very fruitful conversation about that. You also raise a point about the political spectrum in the Doctor Who production offices. Malcolm Hulk as hard left, Robert Holmes is soft left, but to the right of Terrence Dix. Having just listened to the audio commentaries between the years 2001 and 2013 as the original DVDs came out, I was always of the impression that Terrence Dix was the production office's one Tory. I always pictured him as being right wing because of the way that he talks, the character that he plays on the audio commentaries. Turns out he is to the left of Robert Holmes, as what you write in the Black Archive. So the impression that I had of him was entirely wrong.
Well, it's very muddy about, you know, personal politics. I mean, basically, Terrence Dix is another man of his era, and he's not very good with women. I mean, there's even the proactive women in Doctor Who he doesn't handle as well as he could do. You know, for all there's the Sarah's women's lib. He doesn't really know how to handle Leela in print. He doesn't serve Tegan very well. But he's very much, I suppose he's about reasonableness and decency, whereas Robert Holmes is very much a bit more brutal and the world's a you know, Robert Holmes is who Eric Saward wanted to be. But Robert Holmes is broadly kind of on the side of the underdog. But equally, he has some regressive political views too. I mean, when you come round to the two makers, when you come round to the two doctors,
yes,
there's a whole very queasy subtext to that about racial types and inherited racial characteristics, and the idea of misogyny and mongrels. He gives the second doctor this line about Jamie speaking a mongrel tongue or whatever.
The appalling mongrel dialect, yes.
Yes. I mean, and it's so not a second doctor line to Jamie. But I think it's there because there's this whole idea that there are racial characteristics or species characteristics which cannot be suppressed. And it's a very, very uncomfortable because you're expecting someone to come in there and challenge it. But our heroes are as guilty of very questionable thinking as any of the bad guys in the piece. And it's and you know, I again, it's as I say with Cotton, I adore the writing, but every now and again you get a glimpse of the world they grew up in and the attitudes that they took as normal just bobbing around in the background. But I'd rather say that and acknowledge that there are things that are questionable than pretend otherwise. I was writing the John Wiles chapter. A friend said, "Don't go there. Don't touch that." And I think the evidence that we have is there in his work. It's cowardly not to say, I think some of this man's difficulties as a communicator with people, as a leader of people, stem from problems with him himself. And, you know, I can't hand on heart say that John Wiles was a bad man. I could quite believe that he had terrible thoughts that he didn't do anything about. But I've read all his novels. I've read his plays. I've read various other pieces by him. Quite a long, quite odd self-justifying piece about his work in theatre. And he's a man with strange obsessions or unhealthy obsessions. And it felt worth saying because some of that does inform his work, I feel.
I've been a Doctor Who fan for next year will be 40 years. I have seen these episodes, especially the classic series ones, so many times. I'm no longer watching for the plot twist. I am watching for the tone. Mm. I'm watching for the Peter Davison, especially all the non-verbal acting that he does to inject comedy into very unfunny scripts. Great scripts, but very unfunny scripts. I am watching now for the behind-the-scenes stuff. So the DVD, the Blu-ray, the DVD production notes, many of which are Jim Kure Smith, the Blu-ray BD-ROM material where you can read the rehearsal script, the camera script, the transmission script, and see the changes, where you can see Verity Lambert's memorandums about the cast, or where you can see Barry Letts, the very last story he touches as executive producer is For to Doomsday, and writing a note to Anthony Rudis to how this story does not work and somebody has to rewrite it, but it can't be me because my contract is over. I love reading that stuff. So the Black Archives, I'm not just watching the Mythmakers. Oh, how is the Doctor going to trigger the fall of Troy? I want to know what the camera script was like. I want to know if William Hartner really insisted that he not be on camera at the same time as Max Adrian, which we know now is entirely untrue. So for me, the behind the scenes, the making of what goes into the sausage, who was John Wiles as a person, that fascinates me as much as the actual on-screen plotting. So I have gone deep into the behind-the-scenes stuff. So your Black Archives sing to me. And again, I'm coming up on season 3 now because I am reaching in the novelizations a point. We record this in between Kinda and Snake Dance. We are coming to the end of the line where the Target books are giving you 95% new stories. They published 10 Peter Davison novelizations in a row. I am just on the cusp of the point where we're going back to the past. I have The Dominators coming up in a few weeks, book 86.
Oh, you're a big fan of The Dominators, aren't you?
You might well think that, but I couldn't possibly comment.
Sorry for interrupting you.
Oh, no, that's totally worth it. Anytime we can mention The Dominators. Hi, Fraser. It is a fun time on this show.
Oh my word!
But my point is that the first season 3 novelization does not come about until 1985, The Mythmakers, in fact. And then once I get to season 7 of this podcast, which is the 1986 and 1987 books, most of season 3 comes up then. So this is a great way of introducing the chaos and the glory at the same time that was season 3. So I'm very happy to have you on at the exact moment that I did. So we've talked about your Mythmakers Black Archive, which I strongly recommend. And even though I don't think Carnival of Monsters is one of my favorite stories, because as a kid I was looking at it purely on a surface level, and all the subtext would have been lost on me, the way you talk about the vertical integration of the story up and down, and the way you talk about how the interminor plot between the functionaries and the executives parallels what's going on the ship, which I never noticed, the SS Bernice. You talk about how Holmes is talking about oppression but never gives voice to the oppressed. Yeah. And you talk a lot about the camera script instruction, the incomprehensible but clearly revolutionary gobbledygook. That is a great line. It explains so much.
That was it, because there's a book called Writing for Television in the 1970s that Malcolm Hulk did, which was the thing that first made me want to go to Carnival of the Monsters, that it prints that first spaceport scene out in camera script there. And that line of dialogue was in there. And I just thought it was quite lovely to see there was this cheekiness that was going on in Holmes' stage directions, which is, there's another one there, which is like the TARDIS makes its awesome noise or something like that.
Yes.
That made me think there are things to say about the intentions behind Carnival of Monsters. I was also interested in the idea, because increasingly we're used to, and it's kind of happens again in The Deadly Assassin, we tend to read film material as very realistic and set in the real world, and stuff that the interiors in the TV studio very stagey. And what happens in Carnival of the Monsters is that the real world is a terrible stagey spaceport, and the fictional world is largely on film on the SS Bernice. And I thought it was quite a nice misdirect there. And I was also very interested in levels. This idea that Russell T. Davies kind of went into later with kind of vertical storytelling. And I think it's there in things like The Sunmakers as well, that we have the people down in the Undercity going up even into the collector or the gatherer's office, where we have people on various different kind of podiums behind. And just this whole idea of, again, Deadly Assassin, you have the layers of the society and the layers of the city, and you have the gantry where the camera people are. And I do genuinely think that Holmes was interested in breaking down the studio space, which is generally very flat and horizontal, and using kind of stratas, both visually, physically, but also metaphorically. The Carnival of Monsters, I think, is great. I mean, I was very, very lucky to get hold of scripts for that, for three episodes of that, which aren't on the DVD or the Blu-ray. So they're in a private collection, and someone passed them to me, and I was delighted because they were what really unlocked the different layers of what Holmes wrote, what Terence Dicks wrote on top of that, how then Barry Letts restructured the thing because the episodes were all over the place and made... There's only really one little visual element you can see where there's a very ropey edit, and restructured the series. But equally, the thing that really surprised me is one of the most famous bits in the whole show is the Polari, the talking in the kind of either gay or carnival language, is entirely constructed by the actors. And it's one of those bits, again, I think Pertwee wants a moment of charm, and him and Leslie Dwyer come up with this thing together, which is based on a kind of joke about Vorg trying to communicate with people. There's an awful lot of stuff about language in here. Some of it gets cut from the broadcast version, but I think a bit of it is still in the novelization about sort of speaking in kind of pigeon English to try and make yourself understood, and that the functionaries have their own kind of quite informal language. But it's Vorg trying to communicate with people who he thinks are inferior species, and it transforms into this whole thing, this whole delightful Polari thing, which people have for years said is an example of Robert Holmes's wit and joy in language. It's the joy and wit of two old thespians who know the way people around the theatre spoke.
And you go to the Robert Holmes draft, which exists only in private hands, and he was just having them speak in nonsense syllables. Yeah. Heidi hi, bing bing bong.
Yeah. The Heidi High is delightful because Leslie Dwyer went on to be in a series called Heidi High in the UK.
Years later.
Marvellous, Sherlock. What audacity. Do you know, I do believe he's one of us.
One of us? He's a Tellurian.
Well, of course, but I recognise the type. He's in the carnival business, I'm sure. I mean, look at his manner and look at his clothes. Don't forget that I've worked many a Tellurian fairground.
You may be right. He's certainly got the style.
Oh, I wager on it. He's got the measure of these grey-faced idiots right enough. But he understands the Polari. Listen to this.
Hey?
The Tellurian carnival lingo. Watch. Polari the carny. Varda the bonapolone.
I'm sorry.
Nanti denari round here, you jilt.
I must apologize. I'm afraid I do not understand your language.
You understand, all right. You're a showman, the same as me, ain't you?
You a showman, sir?
Allow me to introduce myself. I am the Great Vorg. And this beautiful young lady is Schirner, my assistant.
Delighted, Miss Schirner. I am the Doctor.
Doctor, great title, you know. Doctors, professors, always pulls them in.
Tell me, sir, are you in charge of this disgraceful device?
I would have assumed that it sprung fully formed out of Robert Holmes's brain, but you have an even better footnote in the Carnival of Monsters Black Archive where you talk about how Robert Holmes struggles with the idea of why are these alien species speaking English? And he did a whole run of stories spanning several years where he just avoided the issue entirely before finally writing in as script editor a footnote in Mask of Mandragora, which became text later on in the Russell T. Davies era. So this is all fascinating stuff to read, and I can't get enough of it. So in terms of you personally, what would you consider to be your personal favorite Doctor and some of your personal favorite stories?
It's very tricky because I grew up with Pertwee and Tom Baker, and Tom Baker became my defining Doctor through my young period. But as a child who was small and shy and dark-haired, the idea of Troughton, which I got initially from the Target books, and from those Chris Achilles pictures of him frowning in black and white on the front of the Target books, because it's always kind of almost always the Three Doctors kind of photo shoot that we kind of reach for. This concept of Troughton I had when reading those early Targets. Troughton was very much my platonic ideal Doctor without ever having seen him, and there was very little of him to see at that period. But I guess I formatively I'm a Tom guy, but I really have a lot of time for all of them. I never quite think that I like Pertwee until I watch it, because I think I have this thing that, oh, he's sucking up to the establishment, oh, he's a pompous oaf. But then you see him and he is delightful. And he is, you know, he is a very charming figure. But in my head, I have ideas about him being a terrible... I mean part of the thing, in a strange way, the Pertwee Doctor is the first Doctor to have an arc, in that he is a very selfish man who becomes a little bit better. And, you know, that's very much Barry Letts just dripping that in, letting his Buddhism kind of inform what happens with the Pertwee Doctor. I would think largely incidentally, but he is charming to watch. In terms of favourite stories, I do like a comedy Doctor Who. I do like gritty brutality. I think partly my age... I got the Pyramids of Mars VHS very early on with minor edits to make it about 92 minutes or something. And it rattles along like a steam train. It is a beautiful piece of television, Pyramids of Mars. Yes, there are things you can have issues with, but that's a very compelling piece of storytelling for me, and quite formative in a way. Deadly Assassin I always adored, because I found the Peter Pratt Master absolutely terrifying as a child, and the whole dreamscape sequence really is vastly inappropriate for the age group. Should never have been shown. Mary Whitehouse was absolutely right. It's one of the best things I ever saw as a child, and I adore it. Really shouldn't be allowed. Fantastic.
So in terms of exploring your favorite bits of Doctor Who, are you prepared to be challenged to a game?
Yeah, go on.
You have a choice. You've heard the show. You have a choice between, at this moment, 20 questions and guess that cliffhanger, because the listener limerick challenge doesn't really apply to this interview, and I haven't written any.
Okay.
So you have a choice of 20 questions and guess the cliffhanger.
I think 20 questions will be harder because because my journey with Doctor Who in kind of doing marathons is I've tended to listen to the audio on long walks, but because I'm quite interested in sound and in audio, I've always fixated on the sound. In some ways, the Hartnell stories I'm as clear visually on as I am for some later eras that are fully existent because I've consumed them in audio form more than I have in video. So I think 20 questions is more of a challenge because I think I will get the cliffhangers too easily, he said arrogantly.
Well, in that case, I have selected at random from the archives one Doctor Who story between 1963 and 2022, by no means limited only to the classic series. You have 20 questions, yes or no, to guess who I am. Question number one, who am I?
Are you 4 episodes long in old money? So it would be 4 25-minute episodes or 2 45s or 190.
No, I am not.
Right.
Any of those three.
Okay.
Question two.
Are you set in Earth's history for the time of your broadcast?
I am not set in Earth's history at the time of broadcast. That brings us to question three, and you don't have a yes yet.
Okay. Do you feature a recurring villain or recurring foe?
That's a really interesting question. I'm going to say yes. Possibly with an asterisk, but yes, there is a recurring villain somewhere in there.
Okay.
Or a recurring foe or a recurring antagonist. Question four.
Does more than one performer play a Time Lord in it?
Yes, more than one performer plays a Time Lord in this story. Question five. I can see you smiling. You may get it very quickly.
Okay. Is it a 21st century Who?
Yes, it is a 21st century Who. Now, you're not going to break the record. You're already five questions down, but you may get it in well under 10. What is your question six?
Okay.
A 21st century story with more than one Time Lord.
Yeah. Is it a Stephen Moffat story?
Yes. Yes, it is a Stephen Moffat story. Question seven.
Well, the hesitancy about the villainy makes me think it must be a Capaldi reformed Missy story. So let's...
It's an interesting facet of Stephen Moffat's time on the show is that he takes recurring antagonists but drops them in for cameos. It isn't a story of one alien trying to invade a planet. It's a story with 7 different recurring monsters showing up in cameos, but not part of the main storyline. So that's why I
think
said the asterisk.
I think you're being very kind to me there because that 7 recurring.
Well, 7 was a advised number, not a literal description.
Okay. Well, now more than one Time Lord as well, more than one Time Lord performer. Ooh, now I'm getting myself confused. Okay, we're going to have to go. Is it a Capaldi story?
Yes, it is a Capaldi story. Question 8.
If only it'd been the old series. I can pluck titles from the old memory. The short-term memory is always the first to go, as I believe that Bors says in Terminus.
Yes.
Right, let's think about Capaldi, Moffat. Turning Time Lords.
A Moffat Capaldi story with multiple Time Lords. If you were to look at an episode, yeah, you would probably have it on a snap.
Well, multiple Time Lords, I kind of feel it must be Hellbent.
It is Hellbent, yes.
Oof. Oh, that's a
now
relief.
You have multiple recurring antagonists because you have Rassilon, you have Ashildur, you have the General, who is 2 actors playing the same Time Lord in the same story. And you have a Dalek shown tangentially.
Yeah.
So And then, of course, Ohila, or Ohika, as I still think of her in my headcanon. So yeah, lots of antagonists come back, even if only for brief scenes.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting story to break down into 20 questions, but you got it in under 10. That's very impressive work.
I was trying to avoid doing the Is It 21st / 20 classic thing. I was really hoping I might get a non-four-parter kind of historical, and then we go, oh, then we're there. But no, we got there. I did have to pull out some of the usual guns, but we got there.
It has not happened yet on this show that 20 questions randomly gives me the story that is being discussed. So if I had picked Mythmakers or Carnival out of the randomizer, that would have been hilarious. But no, it was a story that we did not touch upon at all over the previous hour and a half. So Ian, where can people find you? Where can they find your work? Do you have any upcoming projects we might want to hear about?
You can find me most easily. I quit Twitter kind of November, December when Musk was just starting to show his colours. So I went to Mastodon, which means that you have to do a little bit of work to negotiate where I am. But it's Ian Z or Ian Z, or one word, Ian Z Potter or Ian Z Potter, all one word. And it's Mastodon, so just the consonants rather than the vowels, in mastodon.social. I'm also Ian Z Potter on Instagram, but I'm mainly there to see what my friends who take more photos than me are doing. I don't do an awful lot on it.
I've just followed you on Mastodon right now. I have an embryonic Mastodon account, so I'm now following you.
I find there's a thing called Tusky, which is an app to look at Mastodon through, which makes it look a lot more like Twitter and somehow feel more organic to use, because there is a slight learning curve with Mastodon. But what I do find there is, you know, Jim Curry Smith is there, Dale Smith is there. I think John Arnold might be there as well. If he is, I'm sorry, I've forgotten that he's there, but I think he's there. And a lot of the quality conversations I'd be having on Twitter are there without so much of the kind of heated noise that kind of emerges around. It's a great place for a more... You get a lot of reaction of a better kind. You may get a lot more reaction on Twitter, but so much of it has to be filtered out. Bang for buck, I find Mastodon is really fulfills my social needs without making me stressed to the gills.
I will have to spend more time there. And in terms of your work, anything else coming up, or where can we find you there?
Yeah, there's I've done various bits and pieces for Obverse. I have a vague idea for another Black Archive at the moment, but it has a living writer, and I'd really like to have contact with them if I were to do it. So that one is up in the air as to whether they're happy to have someone like me ask them really annoying questions. there are Big Finish things out there and Big Finish things coming up. I've got a very, very small chapter in a Bloomsbury book. I think it's something or other, a Doctor Who reader. I think it's an Adventure in Space and Time or a Doctor Who reader, which is coming out later this year. But yeah, there's the other thing I do quite a lot of, which is quite atypical for British people in that there's only two of us do it, is I do stuff for Riff Tracks Presents. So basically I talk over old movies with a guy called Matthew J. Elliott, who writes a lot of audio drama for the States and has written various little bits about Doctor Who and its extended universe and bits for Big Finish. And we are the people taking your grand American form of shouting over movies and doing it entirely wrongly. But some people like it, and it's quite a fun job. That's probably what I'll be on to straight after this, actually, is working on a riff with Matthew.
I started listening to Riff Tracks at the very beginning because I discovered Mystery Science Theater 3000 when I was in college. We didn't get Comedy Central on my cable TV package in New York, but when I moved away to college, cable TV there carried it. So I started watching MST3K almost immediately. And one of the first MST3Ks that I would have seen on the main Saturday night strand, not the reruns on weeknights, was the switchover from Joel to Mike Nelson. And Mike Nelson, of course, ended up launching Riff Trax. So I go back a long way with that franchise.
Yeah. Yeah. Mike is a really, really nice guy. I was quite ill in 2020 post-COVID. It basically triggered something else with me that then needed an operation. And Mike and Bridget, all the guys were really, really lovely. They're a very warm-hearted team. And the other thing, again, when we talk about comedy, about attitudes, about they've listened to things being said about things they did comically in the past, and they've responded going, okay, yeah, those jokes were punching down, those jokes weren't fair, we're not doing those again. And I think that's the way forward for humor. I mean jokes are great, but so often there's a victim and a power imbalance, and being aware that I think quite often we don't realize that we have power if we're in a position making these jokes, and that you can be abusing it, and it's just an area you've got to be careful with. And I know it's not just about it's a tricky thing, because trying to combine comedy and kindness is a challenge, but it's worth thinking about all the time. If there is a butt of your joke, do they deserve to be a butt of your joke? Luckily, there are loads of people out there who deserve to be the butts of jokes.
Ian Potter, I cannot thank you enough for taking part of your Saturday to talk to me about your Doctor Who-related work. Fascinating stuff. We will find a way to get you back on the show very, very soon. Thanks so much. Have a great night.
You too.
Direction Point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.